welcome to Rural. I am your host and producer, Amy Drury. Sam Bass, Chief Emeritus of the Nansemond Indian Nation, and his son Brian Bass are featured in the first half of this episode, sharing their unique perspectives of rural life and history. Chickahominy Tribal Chief Stephen Atkins joins me in the second half to include his thoughts and ideas.
My name is Sam Bass. I'm a Chief Emeritus of the Nansemond Indian Nation. I presently am serving as a councilman in the tribe. I moved to Suffolk in 1971, built a home on 19 acres of land. There was no real neighbors for maybe a couple hundred yards. Now, in this 50 years, there's house next to house next to house. And only recently did we get some streetlights out there. We don't have fire hydrants. It's still rural in a sense.
My name is Brian Bass. I'm a tribal councilman with the Nansemond Indian Nation. I live in the city of Suffolk. Been here my whole life.
When I was researching the beginning of this, one of the things I found out about Suffolk is that Suffolk is the largest agricultural city in the state. Is Suffolk rural in your opinion?
Yes. In the western, southwestern side of Suffolk, I would say probably 90% of it is rural.
What are some of the characteristics of rural?
To me, rural is not having the amenities of urban areas. There's not a 7-Eleven a half mile. There's not a street light, city, sewer, and water. You supply your own. You know, for a lot of people, that means a lot. For me, it means a lot because I would prefer it that way. I don't want the city providing me with my water. I'm well aware of the testing that they do, and a homeowner is required to do the same testing. So, you know, the water that we get out of the ground from a deep well or shallow well is just as good, if not better, than the treated chemical water that the city provides. Those are the things to me that separate urban from rural, are the amenities that you just don't have.
So Sam, what do you think of when you think of rural?
Things that you just don't have at your fingertips. I consider where I live is rural, and I don't have street lights. I don't have water running. I do have a well, a shallow well, and I do have a septic tank with drain fields. So it's the way it's been. I've lived there for going on 51 years.
Ebony Alexander talked about being able to look out her kitchen window and see, you know, the occasional bear, and being able to walk out in her pajamas. People have said various things about what they really love about rural areas. Clay Jenkinson talked about the smell of manure and being able to have a garden. So what is it that you love about living in a rural area? Because you both do this by choice.
Being able to look out across the field and see a deer, a eagle, a hawk, have enough area to have a garden, grow fruit trees. Growing up, that was something we had, apple trees, plum trees. You wouldn't experience that in the city, in an urban area. It's kind of to be self-sufficient on the land somewhat. We grew up in a generation where you still get your groceries from the store for the most part. During the summer, it may be 50% because we're raising our own. Plums are coming off, apples, beans, squash, you know, we're eating out of the garden all through the summer. Very rarely do you go to the store to buy vegetables. We try to freeze some and eat off of during the winter. That, to me, is the biggest advantage, is just being able to kind of be self-sustaining, not dependent on grocery stores. And I think for the most part, people in the rural area are more laid back.
Well, another thing you can do out in a rural area, you can have livestock, horses and cows and hogs and chickens. And whereas living in the more immediate townships, you're governed by the city on how many of each you can have or if you can have any at all. I'll never say I like living out so I can smell the horse manure of my neighbor that's two doors down from me, but it's part of being in the country. I mean, they work at trying to minimize that by putting down things to kill the odor. Living out is a feeling of freedom, that you're not completely controlled by the system.
Was that important to you to teach your children to appreciate that, or was that just part of your, you know, life was for you?
My father had a garden, would chop and plow, and as he needed assistance, he had children, so we helped out in the garden with certain things he didn't want us to help with because he wanted to do it his way. But even at that, for me, in having a garden was just seemed like the thing to do. I had land, I had open area, I had the tools and the equipment to work the land, and I had assistance, having my children to help out and all. And so now in Brian's life as an adult and having children, having his own place, it may be small, but he has crops or vegetables that are just beautiful and abundant. It's like the hunting skills or fishing and all that from one generation to the next. I have a daughter in Atlanta. She got the bug, and all of a sudden I go there to visit her in the summer, and she's got tomato plants sitting on her deck, and she lives in a suburban area, but she's got tomato plants. And she's asking me, how do I keep the squirrels from getting the tomatoes? She never talked to me about it. It was just something she decided she wanted her children to experience what it is to grow a put a plant or a seed in the ground and see it flourish. And the grandchildren, they knew, they talked about it, and they were interested in keeping it watered and that type of thing. You can be so self-sufficient and take care of yourself if you really have to.
I think it's just so important to put your hands in the dirt and get that connection. There's nothing better than being able to produce something for yourself and be somewhat self-sufficient. Not only does it taste better and it's healthier, but it's also, for me, it's a little spiritual.
And that's the way our ancestors, they knew there was a supreme being, and they knew that Mother Earth, water, air, soil was their life. The creation of animals was to feed them. Thanking God when they did take an animal, they did catch some fish, they appreciated that, and they recognized where it was really coming from. What was providing them to live every day and have food, clothing, and shelter for their existence.
Every year we kill one hog ourselves. We smoke the meat in the smokehouse. And there's usually somebody that's never been around it that's at the farm or wants to see it or experience it. And I tell them that none of us take joy in the killing of the hog. That's not something that we look forward to. And if anybody is flippant about it or jokes about it, we don't tolerate that because it is very reverent. It is a gift. So there has to be that balance of taking it very seriously.
Yes.
Native American agriculture depended on symbiotic relationships and reciprocity. Beans, corn, and squash grown together are known as the Three Sisters. Sam explains.
The Three Sisters is considered by the Native American community as three crops, main crops that the Native Americans used to provide food to themselves. And the three crops are corn, beans, squash. So if you can picture the stalk of corn, and beans had been planted in between the stalks, and they have runners on them, they take the runners and wrap around the stalk and use it as bean poles. In addition to that, they plant squash very close in the near vicinity, and the foliage from the squash covers up the bare ground between the corn and the beans to where it minimizes greatly weeds. These three crops, the Native Americans have figured out if they planted them that way, it minimized the amount of time that they had to be out in the heat or whatever. They could do other things that would provide or needed to be provided for the tribe, the family. Those three sisters is considered to be the basis of a main staple of the Native Americans. And then they had the game or fish, different fisheries out the river or creeks. They knew all these things and did things by seasons. They themselves, without a calendar, a 12-month calendar, could figure out when it was the best time to get game, fish, crops. They had that figured out.
And I'm just thinking, how do we do that on a larger commercial scale?
Well, it works with cantaloupes, because right here at our property, I did find some cantaloupe seeds, and I planted those in addition to the squash and that. And the cantaloupe came up, and the foliage was hanging over the side of the box that we had the sisters planted in.
You think of Three Sisters, we're related. Those three crops complement each other, which in a group of siblings, we're not the same, but we complement each other. We all have our strengths and our weaknesses. Those three staples to sustain one another, which sustains humans, deer, squirrels, any living animal that consumes a herbivore would be like, man, I got it all right here. It's a buffet.
The reciprocity of it all, just right. giving to, you know, each other certain gifts and yes.
And likewise, they use every part of what they harvested.
Sam, would you mind telling me a little bit about your ancestors' lifestyle?
The women of the tribe would do a lot of the manual labor. The men would go into the swamp. Most of the canoes were made out of cypress. It's amazing how they would get a log and move it to where close to their township and work on cutting it down using tools that they had made, whether from animals or other pieces of wood or rock or stone, to dig out the core of the tree to make a canoe. They would start a fire in the center of it and just keep scraping the coals that's in the center of the log to where they would eventually get it to the depth burned out. Once they would start this fire, it was 24/7. They were constantly scraping and digging and getting it to where they want it, to refine it to where they would launch it in the water and it would float. I'm amazed recognizing this type of tree growing in swamps and all, just how Native Americans, Indians, figured out how to do these things.
So what I'd like for us to think about is how far removed are we from doing things that way? You think back to when my granddaddy, who was born in 1912, how he grew up in the Dismal Swamp of hunting and fishing and trapping. Those things were still done. We're only 75 years removed from basically having that kind of mindset of we lived off the earth as hunters and gatherers. That's not that long ago. You know, that's just one generation removed. How Indians adapted to survive as a hunter-gatherer, they were still doing it right up to 75 years ago. We can all survive even in urban areas with potted gardens, hydroponics. There's all kinds of ways we can survive and not be dependent on someone else supplying us with our food.
Very cool. Brian, when did you get your love of gardening? Have you always?
Oh, yeah. From the time I could walk. My granddaddy and my dad had cows, animals, chickens, had big gardens. It was just what you did. And of course, for me, I was always at my granddad's. He had a big garden until he passed. I did growing up every summer, picking butter beans, tomatoes, snap beans, okra, squash. And I can't think of a year that I didn't have some type of vegetable or strawberries, something that I was growing or harvesting. You know, I look forward to it to this day. I mean, I've got my seed in the freezer. I slice the tomato, put it in the freezer, and then I'll thaw it out and put it in the dirt, and the plants are going to come up, and then I use the plants to transplant them and start my tomato garden. There's all kinds of ways and techniques that people save seed, and that's just something I've learned to do that I have good results with. So
I hadn't heard that before about slicing a tomato, then freezing it, and then just putting the half slice in the ground. Because I have had a time with tomatoes over the last few years. I used to be able to grow tomatoes easily, and now with all the diseases and fungus and...
I save the bigger ones that are the softball size, and I just slice them, put them in the freezer. You can also do the same thing by keeping them dormant. If you don't even put them in the freezer, you can just put them in a bag. You need to let it dry. It dries down, but then when you want to start your plants, say on a windowsill or something, you just take a pot and put that one piece in the potting soil and just keep it damp. And once it hits 60 degrees, that stuff, you know, is going to germinate and come right up.
How do y'all encourage people that don't understand the value of growing things or agriculture?
You know, in the world we live in, people aren't patient. And I think it's more important to teach patience than it is to teach them how to grow things. When you learn patience and have understanding of cause and effect and what's going to happen if I do this, the growing, it makes you slow down. You know, you plant a tomato, and I usually have my tomatoes in the ground the end of April, 1st of May. My tomatoes are ready, but you got almost 3 whole months that you're getting nothing out of this plant. What is it good for? But that's 3 months. We have that same patience with our kids, with our spouses, our siblings. But I think if you can get people in a relaxed setting, gardening, and get them to understand the patience and the time that's involved, I think that helps in a therapeutic way.
I just love that, teaching patience first before you can teach anything else. And I think you're so right. People don't take the time to calm down and to really actively listen. Listening is one of the hardest things to do.
And an example of that is I received a phone call from an out-of-state relative. The person, I said, how you doing? And they had something health-wise going on in their family. And the person says to me, so what about you? How are you doing? I said, well, since you asked that, I just went to the doctor. And next thing he said was, well, we're going to take a little trip this weekend, you know. And I'm saying to myself, I know you could hear me because we'd already been talking. I was using the same tone. But the thing was, I interpreted it, not to get my feelings in an uproar, but it was about him. He really doesn't want to know about you. He just wants you to know about him.
When I asked Sam and Brian what they perceived as threats to rural communities and their tribe, this is what they had to say.
I think our threats are ourselves. We're not proving that we are good stewards by our actions.
You know, I just think in America, it's about the dollar. There's few and far between where someone's upfront and transparent. If I eat an apple, I'm gonna give you an apple. If I make $1 million, I want you to make $1 million. I don't want 10 and you have one and then I can overrule you because I have more. And that's kind of the mindset that when society of the people, people in our tribe, we have close to 400 members. They range from California to New York to Maine to Florida, Texas. You know, bring all them together and everything they've experienced in their modern life. It's far from being a native life.
Do you see any solution?
Being respectful of what's been given to us and what our ancestors did. My objective is to be as kind, respectful, do the right thing, and that what I leave on earth is carried on, if it's good things, by my children, and then they carry it on for their children to pass it on to be a good citizen, be a good steward of who you are. So that's my outlook.
Towards the end of the interview, I ask about their vision for the future.
Well, I think it was here when the settlers and the immigrants came to this country. When you see pictures of in history books, magazines, or whatever, if it's a gathering of peace, it's the Native Americans hosting the other people. And that's the way they were. It still would be that way. And the Native American would still be standing on the shoreline with food to help them.
Brian, what does a near perfect future look like to you?
For me, it's just to have one another treated the same. All our prejudice that we have gone and have an understanding. You know, it's hard for mankind to do that. Let's not pull any punches. Native Americans were pretty savage in protecting their boundaries. You didn't cross the boundary to go see a squaw, and if you did and got caught, you didn't live to tell about it. That's how it was.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's mankind as a whole.
It was quite a takeover, and they didn't originally come here to sit around the campfire to sing Kumbaya. They came for the resources and to take over. Yes, they could be savages, but that was bought out of them because of the actions of the invasion, more or less.
What the Native Americans did have were the connection with Mother Earth, and that they didn't want to do harm to anyone else. The only time that would happen is if you encroached on their grounds, and then they would stand up for themselves. Well, naturally, when the Europeans came, they stood their ground and tried to defend themselves, but they were just overpowered, and that's what basically happened.
It really was like an invasion.
No, it was. It was an invasion.
I look for peace and harmony throughout the world.
But I'm glad to see in my lifetime in the last year, a little bit, like I said, not to develop hatred or revenge, but I am pleased that it's being recognized and more or less honored in most states now that there is no Columbus Day.
Yes.
I mean, how do you discover something that there was someone already there? It's a changing of the times of the way life on Earth is going to, we don't know when that day is. We don't know when the day is we take our last breath, but you try to live as honorable as you can. I'm done.
Okay. This concludes my conversation with Nansemond Chief Emeritus Sam Bass and his son Brian. Next, I travel to the Chickahominy Reservation to talk with Chief Stephen Atkins.
My name is Stephen Atkins. I'm chief of the Chickahominy Indian Tribe. Its headquarters are in Charles City County. The Chickahominy Tribe has lived in this area for hundreds of years. I have resided in this area all of my life. I'm really attached to the area.
We began with a little history.
In 1607, when the settlers landed here at what we call Senecamaca, which is part of Turtle Island, they came ashore in Jamestown. And my tribe was one of the 30 to 40 tribes that were here. We welcomed them, hoping that nothing bad would come of it. I'm sure my people were somewhat surprised at the dress of the colonists. I think they probably wondered, are these people civilized? I sure hope they are. And it started out to be a pretty good relationship. As a matter of fact, December 1610, Captain John Smith sent a party down to Chickahominy land to buy corn. They called it the starving times, but the settlers had converted every bit of tillable soil to the production of tobacco. And they ran out of foodstuff, so they traded with the Chickahominy.
What is the Chickahominy relationship to the land?
It's typical among Native peoples. Be kind of married or wed to Mother Earth. We collectively try to preserve this creation that God gave us for the next seven generations. I would love to see that kind of philosophy migrate to the dominant culture. I don't have much hope in that regard because people are very reluctant to accept responsibility or even acknowledge the climate change that we're undergoing and the effects that it is having in both flora, fauna, and other natural resources.
I have been reading Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer on Indigenous Wisdom and Scientific Knowledge, who also talks about working for the next seven generations. When you mention the seven generations, she writes of the honorable harvest of reciprocity in our relationship to the natural world, of the need to rein in our tendency to consume so the world will be as rich for the seventh generation as it is for our own.
When I talk about rural America and how it affects me, I think that the Chickahominy tribe probably embraces some of those values that I may speak of, but we're not monolithic, so I can't speak for all of the Chickahominy, but I can speak for Stephen Adkins, chief of the Chickahominy tribe, citizen of Charles City County, citizen of the United States, and the Commonwealth of Virginia. And I value rural America. I bring some bias because I've always lived in a rural setting. And when I think of a rural setting, I think of farmland, forest, gardens, people who have their own private wells and septic systems. I think of peace and tranquility. And some of that has been changed as people from more affluent areas will come to Charles City County, buy lots of land and put up fences and posted signs, which is very alien to the environment in which I grew up. People will come to the county, go to the Board of Supervisors because they don't like the stench that comes from people who own hog farms. They don't like the fact that they hear the farm equipment when people are tilling their soil and when they're reaping their harvest. People will come to this rural area and want to make it look like a city and feel like a city. I've had people comment, you don't have enough lighting in the county. Perhaps you might reconsider this move.
Gardening and growing food was something all my guests love about rural life.
When I was growing up, we had a garden every year. You know, watch my mom and dad, and I learned how to work with Mother Nature, plant seeds, and watch the crops grow. You know, I remember harvesting potatoes, planting sweet potatoes. You know, I remember we call them butter beans, and people call them lima beans, tomatoes. We had what we call string beans. You go to the restaurant, they're green beans. But we had all of those. Every family's garden turned out to be a community garden. I used to say, wow, Mom, you make us work in the garden, and then you give it all away. But other families did the same thing, and we had horses and cows, pigs. We could have lived off the bounties that 30-some acres that my dad had. I used to say, well, we're just growing hay and corn to feed the horse. But the horse and the cows were vital. We didn't have tractor, and the horse would pull the plow. And ironically, when the settlers arrived, they deemed us moon worshipers and star worshipers. But we understood how the moon affected the tidal cycles. We understand the lunar cycles regarding planting season and harvesting season. And my mom went to her grave planting gardens by the cycle of the moon. And it worked. I would look at her, Mom, is it time to plant? And she would tell me. So in my mind, rural America is that little farm where me and my eight siblings, my mom and my father and my grandmother lived there, where we could have lived off the grid all year long because we produced enough to sustain ourselves. We always slaughtered at least one hog a year. And we had the chickens, we had the eggs, we had everything we needed. And our kids, my brothers, were pretty good hunters. Game was safe when I was out hunting, but that's another story because I didn't have the heart to kill them anyway. Looking at rural America, I see the camaraderie that we had as a community when I was growing up, where if one person hurt, everyone hurt. Where you knew everyone in the community, which is both good news and bad news, because that grapevine would really share some intimate details that are better left private. But it's a community where we might would fight with each other, but we always rose to mutual defense. And I think we build strong people of character in those rural environments. And there's some downsides. The school population, it's not large enough to have some of the curricula that are needed, and I'm saying that plural. There may be two or three kids that want to take advanced math or calculus, and you can't have a class with two people and afford to have the teacher to come in for those two people. Which leads to another problem we've had, which has been remedied somewhat today. But the lack of connectivity, the lack of internet, which would enable us to teach those kids who wanted to take these advanced courses, which are very much needed today in this world of technology in which we find ourselves either reluctantly or not, we're there. And part of living in rural Charles City is we've had frequent power outages. When I look at a rural community, I also look at relationships that can be established to really make the community click, to make it work. When I think of rural America, I think of churches dotting the landscape. So even that sense of community is enhanced and enlarged by the churches that we have, where people really want to ensure that their brothers and sisters don't get caught up in the food desert or other areas of, you know, of economic deprivation that would preclude them to have a good life in this community. So there are values that I think are inherent in rural communities that may or not be in the more urban areas. I've talked to people who will say they've lived by this house two houses down for 20 years and don't know who lives there. And in my view, that's beyond the pale. I guess when I look at rural America, I've said a lot about it, but it's much more than landscape. It's much more than areas defined by being outside of an urban cluster or an urban area. It's much more than the countryside that's outside of city limits. To me, there's a real sense of community that when you walked off your property onto someone else's, you weren't stopped and said, "What are you doing here?" You were a neighbor, and if you wanted to walk across my property, you did. And I grew up without leash laws. Our dog knew to come home, and if our dog offended a neighbor, the dog was disciplined. And they learned quickly. I see the need as the population increases, but I do yearn for those days when we would leave home, and if we chose to lock the door, we would sleep all night with the windows open and, you know, the front door open and not worry about somebody coming in and stealing what you have. And, you know, random acts of violence were random to the point, you know, we didn't see them existing in Charles City County. When I think of rural America, that's part of it, a safe environment to live, in which to live and raise a family. And I view rural America as a plus, even when I cite the disadvantages that smaller counties have because they don't have the critical mass to affect much change outside of their community. You know, Charles City is essentially a bedroom community where most of our folks live in the county and work outside the county. Lots of times, small rural areas find themselves prey to those entities that want to either bring in a landfill or a prison or some undesirable to the general public means of economic development. I just don't want counties to be viewed as dumping grounds for those things that despoil the environment and that can have long-term, long-lasting effects on the balance of nature, the natural order of nature within a community.
When I was reading Braiding Sweetgrass, and I'm kind of quoting from her, she said, "We need acts of restoration, not only for polluted waters and degraded lands, but also for our relationship to the world, to restore honor to the way we live." I thought you were basically saying some of the same things.
You know, I do believe in restoration. The way we treat Mother Nature, if we have in fact disturbed that balance of nature, we need to work to restore it. We need to conserve. We need to preserve. And we need to go back to those areas that have been maligned and trashed and begin the restoration process. If we don't, we fall prey to an ever-devolving, degrading environment, and we can't do that.
Well, you know what? And what strikes me is that when we degrade the environment, we degrade our souls.
Yeah.
When we treat the environment with disdain and disrespect, mm-hmm. we're basically doing the same thing to our humanity because we're so connected to our environment.
When I drive the roadways and see people throw out trash, I become incensed. My wife walks several miles a day picking up trash. And every day she goes out and says, "I hope I don't find much today. I hope I don't see much trash today." And she comes back home and says, "Well, today wasn't the day." And she'll make the route and come back home and have to stop and pick up trash that was thrown on the road while she was making the first pickup. And sadly, that's kind of emblematic of what's going on in lots of places, but on a much larger scale. If I don't begin that recycling at home, how can I expect it to go beyond me? We've got to really move toward restoration. And we use the term mitigation. It really galls me. And mitigation turns out to be, well, I'm going to pay you this much money so I can continue to do the things I'm doing that are contrary to protecting the environment. It's something I think we have to do if we want our planet to continue to exist.
Let me ask you this then. There's such a big urban rural divide. And so I guess I have a couple of questions. Do you think the people that are throwing out the trash that are degrading the environment are the rural people that live here? Or do you think it's the people coming in visiting or just traveling through, or the people that have just moved here? And how can we communicate to our urban brothers and sisters of the importance of our rural areas? Any advice you could give to them?
When I think of how we are, quote, polluting the environment, we're generating waste, I think some of our urban brothers and sisters don't understand that the trash they discard ends up in landfills that actually comes to rural counties. We have been the repository for waste we didn't create. We don't understand that sometimes convenience must be compromised in order to do the right thing. When people shop and they'll look at something and say, well, this is disposable, I can throw it away. If we reduce the demand for those items that are polluting the environment, those items will go away. People don't manufacture products that don't have a market. We have to individually change our mindset to say we won't be part of the large area of consumers. We won't get caught up in consumerism to the point that we support these products. And to date, people haven't had the backbone to let their stated convictions match the reality of what they're doing. And to me, there should be a real sense of urgency. All you've got to do is wake up every day and look out and see what's going on. You know, even in this area, when I was growing up, I don't remember a tornado in this area. I remember when there were distinct seasons. I don't see them now. And I'll admit that. I mean, I prefer temperate weather versus cold, but I yearn to see those distinct seasons where I can go out and just put on a coat and breathe the brisk air.
Part of why I moved to Virginia from Texas. Yeah. Four seasons.
To me, there are some facets of rural America that are starting to vanish. Here at the Chickahominy Indian Tribe, we have an individual who's working on community gardens. It was a tremendous success this year. We're going to expand it next year. The Chickahominy Tribe has partnered with a group in the county to start a food pantry because we're cognizant of the fact that not everyone has the same access to food that we do. I'm confident that part of Charleston County is a food desert. So rural America, I think, is vital to the future of the nation. I think rural areas are vital to the future of the globe, the United States notwithstanding. Communities can work together. We have probably, it's always hovered around 7,000 citizens in Charles City, and roughly 40-some percent white, 40-some black, and about 7 to 10% native, which would be mostly Chickahominy Indian. But we've worked well together, and I think we'll continue to do so. And I'm the kind of guy, my wife says, you don't meet a stranger, and I don't, which could be a blessing or a curse. But I want to reach out to people, and I'll give them a chance to say yes or no. And if they say no, I don't want to be your friend, I'll respect them for that. I'm not going to get in their space if they don't want it. But I yearn for the time that all people can live and work together and have a sense of honoring and respecting the dignity that each human brings to the table. We've got a long way to go there. I'm an eternal optimist, and that's going to be that's part of my plan as we journey to that phrase, the much heralded phrase, the journey to a more perfect union. But we've got to do it by engaging with each other. And I think these grassroots rural communities are very important for us to move that aspirational goal closer to reality.
What do you think the future looks like?
What do I think the future looks like? That's kind of I could talk all day on that, but I believe the emerging generation. I think they're not going to be satisfied with the status quo. And I really look at them as our hope. I've gone to many universities and talked about the Chickahominy Tribe. And these students, and some of these are PhD candidates. And they are they're beyond angry. So they're not satisfied at being told this is this and that is that. They want to understand how we arrive at that conclusion that it has to be this way, it has to be that way. The kids that I talk to aren't happy with what's happening with the environment, and they want to make a difference. And I think folks who have the fortitude to stand up and speak the truth to power can influence these people. And I believe they want a better tomorrow than the today in which they live. You know, I used to really want my kids to have a better life than I did. I was the first person in my family of 9 siblings to obtain a college degree. I'm the only one of those siblings to have a college degree. And we're having kids today who want to make a difference. They need to be taught the realities of the world in which we live, the reality of the changes in the environment, and what they can do to affect positive changes. Changes are going to occur. They don't have to be negative. So we've got to figure a way. We must figure a way to instill those values in these youngsters who really want to preserve and protect the environment. We've got to provide a platform for informing the decisions they make as they move ahead. And I hope people understand that. It is up to us to help these youngsters inform decisions that will protect this planet Earth and also rural America. I don't know whether you have enough to do anything.
I have great, great material. And thank you so much for taking the time out of a really, sounds like very, very busy season right now and schedule. So I'm grateful that you did that. Thank you for listening to the last episode for 2022's Rural. I hope the reflections from my guest have been thought-provoking, educational, and more than anything, inspiring. We need great minds to help confront the challenges faced by the hollowing out of our rural communities. We can't go back in time, but we have control over the future. If you believe the qualities and values that sprang from rural life are important and worth cultivating, write to me at amydrury@gmail.com. I would love to hear your thoughts. I am so grateful for all the guests who generously devoted their time and brain power to the challenges facing rural life and willingly shared this with you and me. I want to extend a huge thank you to recently retired David Berenger of the Virginia Humanities, Regina Brayboy of Healthy Suffolk, and Heather Mazzoni and Chuck Dowd of WHRO, for whom the series would not have been possible without their help and support. Lastly, I want to thank my husband, Michael Drury, for his insight and love of agrarian rural communities that inspired me to produce Rural. I am deeply, humbly grateful. I'm your host and producer, Amy Drury.